episode.
Welcome back. This is season 2, episode 2. And this week we're joined yet again by my co-host Rob.
Hello.
And this week is made possible by our sponsors Fujifilm and Studio Access, but more on them later in the episode. So this week we're going to be covering Godox hate. We're going to revisit my proposed hatred for Godox. We'll go into that in a bit. We're going to talk a little bit about how AI has changed in advertising and in society, because since the initial influx of AI videos on YouTube, in terms of, you know, photographers talking about it, there's been some pretty big developments. We're going to discuss shortly time is money, because I keep hearing people saying it in the incorrect time, which is costing them money. A little bit about TTL Flash, which we've never discussed on this channel at all, but I think we've both used over the years with varying degrees of success. We're going to talk about my portrait photography setup, because it is now done and dusted and finalized. And we're going to talk about nude portraits, which caused a bit of a stir when I posted about it in our Facebook group, Tin House Studio. But yes, we'll dive in with the Godox hate revisited. And the reason I'm bringing this up is one of my videos I posted ages ago has started to pick up views. And it's picking up views outside of my audience.
Yep.
So there's a lot of very hateful comments coming into my channel at the moment. And I think something which perhaps people don't know about the channel is that it's aimed at commercial photographers who work in the exact remit that I work in. Now, of course, a lot of the information, like flash is flash, it works the same everywhere. You can transfer it to any genre of photography, but I talk from my experience and my usage. So what is a good light for me, and which is a good light for you, would probably be very different things, you know. And I mean, I assume a lot of these people don't watch the video, because I go through it mathematically and you can't really lie when it comes to the numbers. But there seems to be a view that I hate Godox, which, I mean, how long have you worked with me for?
11 years.
11 years. Yeah. And out of those 11 years, 10 of them I've used Godox. Or Pixapro, which is like the UK distributor for Godox, or something along those lines. But we've used, when we shot weddings, we used Godox flashes.
Yep. Many of them.
Many of them. They did catch fire regularly. but we used them because they were cheap. And if you've got a Canon 580 EX2, which was like 400 quid at the time.
Yes, you could buy four Godox for exactly the same cost.
Exactly. And the light quality was almost as good. You know, for weddings, it was more than good enough.
Yeah, in that kind of run and gun kind of situation. Yeah,
more than good enough. Would I use it on an ad campaign today? Absolutely not. But more than good enough for that. In the studio, up until I bought my Broncolor kit, I was using the AD1200s.
Yep.
Packs and heads by Godox. They were brilliant. I don't think I had any complaints about them, apart from the batteries died within a year.
Which isn't good, because those packs aren't cheap.
No, they're not. I mean, the batteries, you can buy a new one for like 200 quid, but I don't know. Three of those years, £600 a year, it's quite a lot of money for that. But yeah, my battery died pretty quickly, and subsequently the light went. But again, it cost £1,000, I think. Similar offerings from Pro companies like £3,000.
Oh yeah, but I say it's three, four times the cost. And you know, you have to always consider that the value for money proposition, and that really comes down to, again, the kind of user you are.
Yeah.
If I mean, I would consider you something of a power user where flash is concerned.
Yep.
I think it's probably fair to say. Now, your requirements will be different from, you know, the average hobbyist, for example.
Exactly.
Now, would it make sense for the average hobbyist to go into Profoto Broncolor? Absolutely not.
No.
In terms of bang per buck, what you get with the Godox products, I think, is non-unbeatable, really.
I'd say so. I think it's probably the best bang for buck lighting kit. But regardless of that, people seem to think that I hate Godox, because I said I can't use it because professional assistant, well, you were here, weren't you? Evie came in. Yep. Evie knows more about my Broncolor packs than I do. And she doesn't even own a light. But she's a professional assistant and she knows about Broncolor and about Profoto. And everyone going, well, all assistants should learn Godox. No, they shouldn't, because no rental house stocks Godox.
Yeah,
and because of that, nobody shoots Godox, because I'll be damned if I'm honking all this kit down to London for a shoot when we can just get a rental house to deliver for us. We either have the Broncolor rental house or the Profoto rental house. And which one we get is purely based on who can deliver that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not too fussed which brand I end up with. I prefer Broncolor. I do think it's better than Profoto for still life work and for accuracy and color consistency. But I've shot as many campaigns on Profoto as I have on Broncolor. And I don't know, they both seem good to me.
Yeah. And again, this is back down to, again, the audience and who this product is aimed at. If you can't rent a certain thing, and importantly, your assistants aren't familiar with it, that immediately starts to cause delays on the job, and especially when it's time is money and you've got one day to, you know, get your shot list completed.
Absolutely, absolutely. But on the flip side, there's not a campaign I've shot that I couldn't have shot on Godox. No, the deal with Greg's a few years ago that we couldn't have done on Godox, but that's rare. Like, it's...
Yeah, it's more, and again, we sort of alluded to this in previous episodes, where the market has changed now, where some sort of moving pictures now, for example, is almost a bolt onto every shoot that you're going to find yourself doing. And that's the one thing you do notice the difference in when you're doing a 20 shot GIF.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, if that light moves just a tiny bit,
it's
really noticeable.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. But again, to you know, your average sort of hobbyist or, you know, sort of semi-pro, that's not really an issue.
I think if you're charging less than 10 grand a day, Godox is the brand.
Yeah.
Like, you can't justify Broncolor on less than 10 grand a day. You know, and I know this because I had to wait. And I wanted Broncolor years ago, but couldn't afford it. But what I would say is, as a negative on Godox stuff, when we have shot full days in here of high volume, the flashes always overheat.
Mm.
But they're not designed for that. They're not designed to be hammered all day long. Whereas it was the same with Bowens when we shot Bowens. You used to have to, like, let them have a little chill out at lunchtime.
Yeah.
And the flash temperature on Bowens used to change that. They'd get warmer and warmer. So you'd have to settle your lights to the same power if you had a heavy day shooting. Otherwise, they'd start warming up at different rates. So you'd have to make sure your key light and your background lights were all light nice and... Otherwise, the background starts turning blue at lunchtime.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have no hate towards Godox. It doesn't work in my business model. One of the things I did notice, though, was a lot of photographers misunderstand corporate photography and commercial photography. So a lot of people are like, I'm a commercial photographer. I shoot business headshots all day long and I use Godox. I can't rent. It's like, you're not a commercial photographer. You're a corporate photographer.
Yes.
Unless you're shooting a billboard advert, you're not a commercial photographer. It's a very different thing.
Those headshots are not being used for a campaign.
No. I mean, sometimes I have shot headshots for campaign before, but that's a very different thing as well. But yeah, it's not the same thing. It's very different. And the business model is very different. I know other people are going, oh, I don't live in London or New York or Paris, so we don't have rental houses. It's like, yeah, that's great. Shoot Godox. Like, there's a quick answer for that. You know, this is just what works in my business, in my business model. But I thought I'd bring it up because the video is picking up traction again and the hate is incoming.
And I think it's one of these things as well. I mean, again, we're both good Godox users and have been for many years. You know, when you find something that's good value for money and 95% of the time does a job for you, you get kind of attached to it.
Oh, yeah.
And
then
when you see somebody, again, if you only quickly thumb through it and scan read the video, there's like you said, you can't use Godox commercially, and you get a bit upset about it because you're sort of passionately invested in your kit, in your branding, but without listening to the full context and saying, this is the reason why.
Yeah.
But for almost everything else, it's perfectly good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if Godox went and sent me a whole bunch of studio lighting today, you bet everything shot in the studio would be shot on Godox.
And I have to say, over the years, and you probably notice it has got a lot, the kit has got so much better.
Have you seen the new video stuff they got? Yeah. The Nold, is it called?
Yep.
And you know I feel about Noling, but
that's
a video in itself, Noling is. But yeah, their new video stuff is insanely good. But yeah, so I just thought I'd quickly touch on that before diving into AI and how it's changing advertising. And this, and again, following on from last week, conversation with children, this comes from a conversation with one of our children. And I was sat down scrolling through something and he's going, oh, that's just like AI. In the most dismissive way possible. I was like, what do you mean? He went, oh, it's just AI stuff. There's loads of it on the internet now. It's just rubbish. And I think that's a big change. Everyone's like, AI, people who use AI for their advertising are cheap. And if they're cheap, the product's cheap. And I don't know if you've noticed this as well, but it seems to be like a huge reality in photography is coming in hard, and AI is just, I mean, the low end will be awash with AI, but nobody wants AI for their high end work.
No, I mean, you need something a bit more individual than that. You know, if you've got, you know, say for example, McDonald's, they're not going to use an AI anytime soon because they've got a very distinct customer base and they've got a very clear tone of voice.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's even deeper than that. It's even down to like, and it's something I don't normally discuss, but the aesthetic of the capture. So like digital files have a look. And for years before AI, everyone was like, it looks digital. And now it's like, oh, it looks AI. Digital is now film. Film is now like cave paintings. But it's that like, if it looks AI, it has no soul. It has no value. And, you know, even, you know, when we shot the Johnson & Johnson's campaign, I spoke to the creative director and I was like, why don't you CGI these? And he was like, because we want the imperfections. We want the misprinting, where the print's slightly out of focus, where there's a scratch on the bottom. We want to keep some of that so it's real. Because if it's just CGI, no one loves it. You can't love something which is fake. It's got to be a real thing. And I think this is a big tide turning point for AI in photography. And I think it will be the savior for the high end. However, I do think the low end of photography is doomed commercially. Like, why? It won't be long till you just bang a phone picture of your product for Amazon, put it into an AI thing, and it'll generate a really nice picture of it. I'm sure you can do it already, to be honest.
And again, for the most part, especially if things like Amazon listings, what have you, you're not really trying to sell the product, you're just trying to represent it.
Yeah, here's what it is.
Is what it is.
But yeah, I just thought, you know, worth mentioning because it's definitely changing. And the fact that the kids are so anti-AI and it's a scam to them. It's fake. It's not real. Yeah. It's like, you know.
It's almost, I mean, it's like, and food photography kind of went that way. I remember like back in the day, you know, cheese pulls weren't, it was glue and your ice cream was made out of mashed potato and you're putting hairspray on your asparagus and all these kind of things. And I think that kind of died a death in the 90s, really. Now, very much of late, everything is very much, no, it has to be the real product as your customer would see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, always the best version of it hidden on piano wires and various
things. Oh, yeah, for sure. We sexy it up, but it is absolutely real food and real drink nowadays. Unless there is a logistical reason why it can't be, which is so rare. And I think because it is so rare, it's what makes the headlines.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think we're a bit safer in the photography realms because of AI, because of that. The fact that CGI is not wanted. I mean, CGI is not cheap either. Everyone's like, CGI is going to replace photography. It costs more. Good CGI, not bad CGI. Bad CGI is really cheap, but so it's bad photography.
But you know, there's certain things you can do with CGI that's literally impossible to do in the real world.
Yeah, there's that as well.
So again, it's all down to the brief, you know, and what is it you're trying to achieve? Whether it's better done practically or with, you know, good CG.
But it's the same with photography. It's like, is it better to photograph it or draw it or graphic design it? Like, there's still that conversation for photography. It's not like we're the only option for an advert.
No.
You know, it's, I don't know. But there we go. Now, coming back to one of our sponsors for today, which is Fujifilm. Now, this, I did all this before Fujifilm even sponsored this episode. So this is it's kind of quite a cushy thing. And as you know, the sponsors on this channel will only ever be brands that I like and use. Now, I've been using Fujifilm for nearly a year now. And I use the GFX system, which is their like more than full frame sensor. And we had lots of discussions about this before going into it. And what I want to talk about now is my portrait photography setup, because I finally got it dialed in. And yeah, I've got it dialed in. We'll get some B-roll to wash over this to make it a bit more interesting rather than me just rabbiting on about pixel peeping. But I've been shooting the GFX for a while for still life, obviously. That's been going on for a while. And then we shot portraits. And of course, when it came to portraits, we had to think of lenses. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I went and rented every lens I might possibly need. And I had two zooms. And I had two primes, and they were all good. And the thing which was really interesting though was the zoom I used, which I think was like, I think it's classed as a standard zoom. It's like a 45 to 100. I'm just checking this in the computer to make sure it is a 45 to 100. Yeah, 45 to 100 f4. I have been, and I've got a video about this, which has already gone live on the channel, but I have been anti-zoom lens. I'm sure you know, I'm like, it's got to be a prime. It's got to be a prime. Why would you use a zoom when you can use a prime? Primes are better. The quality of the 45 to 100 millimeter zoom lens is so good. With my eyesight, I could very much assume it was a prime. Like, looking at the images, unless somebody said it's a zoom, I wouldn't know. And you edited them as well, didn't you? It's a big lens. My biceps got a workout that day, but that is going to be the only lens I have for my camera, for my portrait work. It's going to be the GFX and the 45 to 100 because it is so versatile. There's kind of three focal lengths I was shooting between, which was like 45, somewhere around 80, and then all the way in at 100. Could get three lenses. And do you know what? If I hadn't have tested this, I would have got three lenses. But the zoom is just is banging. So I'm getting that. I'll probably get the 80 as well because I am still a bit of a sucker for primes. But
yeah.
So this is a setup we've gone with. Now, I did go back when we shot the Vicky Pollard style shoot to my old camera setup, which was less than full frame. No, it was full frame. My old camera setup was full frame with a zoom lens on, similar kind of zoom. And the files were fine. I'm not going to say they're rubbish. They were fine. But the Fujifilm has a, and I don't know how to describe this to people who aren't film photographers, it has a thickness to the negative. So when you pull it in post with the GFX file, there's like a thickness to it in that when you move stuff, there's so much more movement you can make. It's like, it's similar to when, you know, we went from shooting video on DSLRs and then got the, like the raw video cameras and it's like, oh, I can correct white balance in post. It's that kind of jump again. I'm pleased with the portrait work we got. I think it works really well, but I'm pleased with the setup as well. Cause I strive for simplicity in my camera setups. I want to be the minimalist photographer. And then obviously if you look around my studio, you'll realize very quickly I failed. And I have all the cameras, all the lenses, like all the lights. I want to be simple, but I'm not.
I mean, I will challenge that to a certain degree in that you've accumulated a lot of swag over the years, but most of that is niching down to what you like to use. I mean, you've got a lot of stuff, but you tend to use the same thing shoot in, shoot out now.
I know, but I still don't get rid of the stuff I don't. I should sell all the stuff in here that I don't use. I basically need one light, my 45 to 100, the GFX. Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah,
I rarely use modifiers. That'd be
99% of everything you need.
Yeah, I know, and it's I don't know, but yeah. So anyway, I'm chuffed to bits with the new setup. The files are beautiful, the skin tones, and again, when I was shooting product only, it wasn't such an issue. But having a bigger than full frame sensor in portrait work, as I think we mentioned this last week in the podcast, didn't we?
Yes,
the difference is huge. You know, being able to use the longer lens closer up and like just the physics of it is so important for portrait work, you know. And I think, you know, there's types of work where you can use a tiny sensor, but I don't think portraits is that. Same with landscapes. I think landscapes, you need a big sensor to really capture the depth. Yeah, otherwise,
there's so much detail.
On a tiny sensor focused to infinity or whatever, you're not getting much. You need a big sensor. And the thing which was important to me, this is what we spent, I spent most of my time talking at you about, was the color bit depth.
Yes.
And the colors, because my work is all about color. And I'd reached the limitations of the previous brand's color options, I think is the best way to put it.
And especially when you're talking about skin tones. Now, products tend to be much simpler. But, you know, with skin, you know, you've got hundreds of different colours in one person's face.
It's insane. And the thing, even with products, though, when we're shooting five different red items together, trying to get the right red for each item was impossible. Mm. Whereas now we're in there. Now, the other thing Fujifilm has is the X series, which is a colours like film and is something I said I wouldn't use. It's kind of like when you go into your color profiles in your other camera brands, but these are film stocks. Now, for those who don't know, I shot Fujifilm for years, as in the film. I was a 400 Pro H shooter and a Velvia shooter. Velvia is the super low ISO, super saturated transparency. And the Pro 400H is kind of like the jack of all trades, often used portraits, natural light. But I'm using the Velvia preset on my Fujifilm and then adjusting from there in post rather than coming out with a flat raw. I like the preset. It, I liked Velvia. You know, I think it's a nice, in terms of colors, it's brilliant. And in terms of grain, it was like a super fine grain transparency. I believe there was a 50 ISO, which is what I used to shoot, 100 ISO. And I think they did a 200 as well, which I've never shot. I think that was before my time. But yeah, I like those. It's the Fujifilm X series colors, and it's got all their film stocks that you can just apply to it. Now, granted, I use the Velvia and only the Velvia for my studio work, but when I go traveling, I take an X100 with me, which isn't part of this sponsor whatsoever, but I shoot JPEG just with film stock things because I don't want to edit my holiday photos.
Yeah.
And I'm fed up of trying to explain to airports not to X-ray my film. So I'll just take an X100.
Yeah, that's how to be, because you still get some of that. What's the word I'm looking for? It's a difficult thing to put, because you think it's a color grade with some grain on it, but because again, obviously the Fujifilm got such a rich history of producing film stocks.
Yeah.
You know, they're some of the most widely used in the industry. You know, that when you kind of see it, you kind of know exactly what it was.
Yes,
because you've seen that before, and it's got some, and there's something emotive about that. So yes, that was.
Yeah, that I was think wrong. That's an interesting point. Actually, the emotive thing is like photographs in digital cameras look the way they do today because of how they looked in film before.
Yes,
like it's all like certain brands try to mimic certain color palettes.
I mean, everybody's, and it's always chasing the film look.
Yeah, I know. Do you know what? I get so annoyed every time because I'm adding film grain to my photographs. It's like, why don't we just keep shooting on film, everybody? If everyone does it. But, you know, there we go. It's never going to happen with the workflow of commercial shooting.
No, I mean, convenience is unparalleled in the digital world, really.
Yeah, but we are shooting on film again soon. Karen's coming down. We're shooting film for a day. It's all in the freezer at the moment. So you have to take it out of the freezer, defrost it, put it into the fridge.
You've never really stopped, have you?
No, I've always shot film. I love it. It's like a sadistic way to burn through money. Almost is. I can either shoot film or buy an old Jaguar. They're my two options.
Yeah, I know where I'd be.
Yeah. But there we go. So my portrait setup, it's finalized. That is it. It's the zoom, it's the GFX, it's the, you know, the medium format. And I mean, we've only done the one shoot.
Yes.
And we're still editing it now.
It was a two-dayer, in fairness.
It was a two-dayer with what? I think it was 20 looks.
Yeah,
It was a lot of footage as well for filming it, but also the files we shot. I shot loads,
yeah,
thousands of frames. And we didn't have any issues, which is good. Like it was seamless. There was no tech issues throughout the shoot.
No. Everything just kept on trucking.
Yeah, it was brilliant. So yeah, smashing it. Good lighting, good cameras, good lenses. It was good. I'm happy with it. We need to do another one. Maybe next weekend is when we do the next sitting. We'll crack out the camera and lens again. Speaking about being really busy, time is money. I'm sure you've heard people saying that time is money.
Yeah, and then there is truth to that.
There is truth to that. Now, I want to break this down for people because, and for full disclosure, I've been useless at finances for most of my life. Not because I tried and failed, but because I just didn't see the point, so I didn't try. So for a large portion of my life, I spent frivolously. And then I had a bit of a panic and got incredibly sensible. And I now treat money and business with the most conservative approaches ever. And the thing I used to do is time is money. If I walk there, it's going to take me longer. If I get an Uber there, it'll be quicker. So paying for that Uber, time is money. And there is a truth to this, but the problem is most people utilize it to buy something they want to buy. So they'll be like, well, if I get this here, it offers this feature, and time is money. Time is only money when you have too much work to service in the time you have. So for example, having you come in to help me edit whilst I do other work, that is a time is money thing. And it also allows us to make more money than the cost of having you in here.
Yes.
If I had you in here and we produced no more work, but I got to not do it, that isn't time is money. Now, if I've got loads of money and I want to do that because I don't want to do the work, that's fine. You know, that's not a problem. But me buying, so we talk about new computers regularly because mine are slow. If I buy a new computer because time is money, and say for today, for example, we had a new computer, we might have saved, what, 5 minutes today so far?
Well, I wouldn't say that we haven't rendered anything yet, so no.
But this is the next point. But the rendering happens overnight.
Yes.
So whether I render out in 10 hours or 1 hour...
doesn't matter.
Time is not money because we're all sleeping anyway. So I think there's a big thing where like people try and justify their purchases because time is money. Or like, oh, I need better autofocus and my hit rate's better because time is money.
Yeah, that not so much.
No. I love listening to people try and justify the fact that they need the latest camera. I'm like, well, I do fun and I don't have it. And
I mean, just be honest about it. You know, if you want one, go.
Yeah. And this is the thing, like, so some people are like, why did you buy that? It makes no sense. Like, because I wanted it and I had the money. Now, if I don't have the money, I won't buy it. But like, we were discussing buying a Jag earlier. If I buy a Jag, I know full well it's going to cost me 10 grand a year to maintain it. If I buy that, it is not a sensible purchase, but if I can afford it and I want it, I'll buy it.
Exactly.
And that's absolutely fine. But, you know, it's the same. Like if I go and buy the new computer because I'm fed up of waiting 2 seconds every time I click for something to happen after doing a certain task. If I want to buy it because that annoys me so much and I can afford it, good stuff. But that is not time is money. That is just, I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, I mean... And then this is back down to the, you know, what is it for and what is it for? So a lot of people, obviously, you know, your channel is very much about the business of commercial photography. Now, I think we can both say with some certainty that if you walk into the average camera club, they've got better gear than either of us have.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people have better gear than I have, up until recently, maybe.
It's very much because that's their hobby, their interest, their passion. And of course, like the aforementioned V10 Jaguar,
yep,
you will pour money into your passion projects.
No, absolutely.
And find a way to justify that to yourself.
Yeah.
But don't kid yourself for a moment that that was a commercial decision because it wasn't.
No, and yeah, and I think that's, you know, I think if there's nothing, like you say, it's fine to do it if you want to do it. If you've got the money, go and burn the money. Absolutely. But yeah. I think kidding yourself that it's a business choice is just, I like some of the conversations I've had with people, I'm trying to help them out. I'm like, get rid of all this kit. I need it. No, you don't. I promise you, you don't. Like if I can do it without it, you can definitely do it without it. But there we go, which kind of brings us through to our second sponsor. That was a very unseamless segue, but the second sponsor for this week's episode is Studio Access, which is my platform. So I'm sponsoring my own channel. That's how we're funding today's episode. Studio Access is a monthly educational platform that we have over at tinhouse-studio.com. You pay a small fee each month. It's less than going out for a drink with me. And you get to learn loads of stuff. It's all the content I can't put on YouTube. You know, we've got 4 videos and portrait shoots up there. We've got 2 really long form videos, like an hour plus. Working with professional food stylists, professional drink stylists, professional assistants. We've got curation of books and portfolios, talking with my the art buyer I work with, Karen. Got a load of stuff about like how to actually maintain lights so they last a long time. There's all sorts on there. What else? I've got some stuff on security. We're just editing a video at the moment on shooting ice cream, which isn't real actually, but we go through all of that in there and the legalities of it. But yeah, I'll pop a link down below for everyone who wants to join me. And it's basically where we put all the stuff that's really useful that will tank on YouTube. And therefore I can't afford to make it on YouTube. It just doesn't make financial sense. But over there, it's great. We've got a community, we've got a secret Facebook page. And yeah, I don't know. Anything else to add?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's like, as you said before, people tend to go to YouTube for a quick fix.
Yeah, these are not quick fixes on Studio Access. These are painful fixes. These are.
But that's how you get on in the commercial world.
Yes, absolutely. By
going down the painful route.
Yeah, this is not information for 99% of photographers. This is for people who actually want to shoot professionally rather than hobbyists. I mean, if you're a hobbyist, by all means, there's a few on there and they go, I love learning what professionals do. I have no interest in being a professional, but I find it interesting. But if you do want to be a professional, that is where you'll find the information you need on how to shoot, how to light. We also have a lot of banter on there on set. So you sort of get a good idea as to what it's like to actually work on a set. But yeah, we're back to filming that again next weekend, aren't we?
We are indeed, yes.
Fine and dandy, I think, which is good. But yeah, so that's the second and final sponsor for this week's episode. And what I want to do now is dive into TTL Flash because, and this, I don't know why it started happening. I've started seeing loads of articles and YouTube videos online about TTL Flash again. It seems to have disappeared for years. And, you know, I mean, I obviously don't use TTL flash because I shoot in a studio, and well, it's never going to get it right.
Yeah, of course not.
I did used to use it in weddings when I started out.
Yep.
But then I quickly realized that when metering through the camera, if you move your camera a centimeter to the left, you get a new metering. And then you have to edit every photo separately. So it was actually better. And what I ended up doing is holding the flash in one hand with my thumb on the wheel dial and having it on quarter power. And depending on the distance of the subject, moving it up and down with my thumb. And I managed to dial it down to such a fine art that I could meter it perfectly.
Yeah, it's consistent shot to shot.
Edit one and sync the lot. But TTL, I don't understand why it exists. Because it won't work off camera because it's metering the distance of the camera. So unless your light is the same distance, yeah. Which seems like, I mean, of course it will happen sometimes, but that's not a, I don't know. What are your takes on it? I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I've used it, but again, I only tend to use it in sort of run and gun scenarios really. And that's mostly with the flash mounted on camera, bouncing off a ceiling or a wall, which tends to be more consistent than sort of pointing it straight into somebody's face. And most of the time it's okay.
Yeah, bouncing's not too bad. But again, if I was going to photograph you now, and then I changed up my meter and picked up on that white wall behind you, it would underexpose you.
Yes.
And if that wall was black, it'd overexpose you.
Yeah. And I also found it's, I mean, certain lenses, the 24-105, for example, whether you're at the 24 end or the 105mm end, the exposure is completely different.
Yeah.
Throughout the zoom range, that will change, but the camera doesn't know that.
No.
And as such, your TTL flash doesn't know that.
I just find it like, I mean, photographers spend ages learning about lens sharpness and things like that and ISO, and nobody bothers to learn the inverse square law. It's one of the, like, I just do not understand it. Whether you're a natural light or an artificial light photographer, if you don't understand it thoroughly, I mean, you're just leaving so much on the table. And using TTL just says, I don't know the inverse square law.
Again, it's back to, it's a convenient idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great idea for, you know, I mean, oh yeah, to be fair, on the X100, I use the TTL version of flashing there. But I don't edit the shots, and they don't have to be consistent because they're just for me.
Yeah.
But if I'm shooting a wedding again, not a chance. Not TTL. It's just, it never gets it right. And then you used to have that problem with the Canon 580 EX1 version, where every now and again, it just threw out full power flash.
Yeah.
For no known reason. I remember the first one I met someone else, I'm like, does your, yes, full power flash every like 25th frame for no reason. Always at the most critical time, yeah, like the first kiss, bang. Then the recycles ages. And we used to have those AA battery packs. We put 8 AA batteries in it, plugged it underneath the camera. And then we moved to the
lithium packs.
Lithium packs, yeah. They were better, but they made my flashes catch fire. And there's those AA batteries 1 year, which had really fast recycling time.
Yes.
Not the on loop, something else, or a different type of chemistry inside them. And then the batteries exploded inside the flash 1 year when I used it too much.
Yeah, but you did hammer them though.
Yeah, well, full power flash is the way forward.
So, I mean, really, it was pointless for you because you're only ever going to shoot the flash at full power anyway.
Yeah, I know. So
you don't need TTL to tell you that.
No, absolutely. But yeah, I don't know. I just thought I'd bring it up because I every now and again, it's like, they're like, oh, there's a new like season of mugs coming through photography to sell TTL flashes.
I don't think it's fundamentally changed really in the last 10 years. I think that's kind of why it kind of almost became a forgotten subject.
Yeah.
Is because everybody's kind of aware of it. Used it and nothing has really changed.
No, it still doesn't know where the flash is.
Yeah. Which, again, that's one of the law of physics
and
things.
You see these tutorials going, oh, and also you can, you know, change the exposure compensation. By the time you're changing exposure compensation on the flash, just power the flash.
Yeah, you might as well be doing it manually at that point.
It's the exact same thing.
A third of a stop, a full stop, it's like double the power rule.
Yeah.
Double, you know.
I don't know. Anyway, that brings us through to our last topic this week, which is, we're not going to go into too much detail here because there is a massive video essay on the way. But I caused a bit of a ruckus in my Facebook group by asking people's opinions on nude photography and nude portraits. And one thing I didn't realise, and I've obviously given off this opinion without realising I'd put myself out there, people, some of the comments were, oh, well, you hate people who shoot nudes. I don't know if anyone's noticed what's up on the walls behind me, but there's very much a naked lady on the wall behind me. And I'm leaving this at the end of the video in the hope that YouTube doesn't spot this bit and like demonetizes my channel. There are nude pictures throughout this studio. We have a huge nude. Have you seen the nude in the sitting room in our house?
Yes, very recently.
Oh, yes, of course you were there, weren't you? Yeah. It's bigger than this table. It's a huge nude painting on the wall. There are nudes up the stairs. I, as Rob will probably agree with, much to his detriment, I have no problem with nudity. There's a... You know, there's from the table down, it's a very different scene on this pod. I should clarify, that is not true. But, you know, I have no problem with nude photography. I have a problem with creepy photography, and everyone does. I don't think that's specific to me. But what I have a problem, and I think where I've made this be a bit of a miscommunication is, when people send work in to me, a commercial photographer with a commercial photography channel wanting to be commercial photographers, and it has nudes in it, of course I tell them, no, you can't have loads of naked women in your portfolio if you want to be shooting ad campaigns. That is not what people are looking for. Go and find me a billboard on the streets with a naked lady on it.
You won't.
No.
Simply put.
Do I have a problem with people photographing nudes? Absolutely not. Fill your boots. It's not something I do, but, you know, I also don't shoot landscapes.
No, and like, if you look at the human condition, you know, humans have been fascinated and celebrated nudes since the earliest of cave paintings.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I have no problem with nudity whatsoever or nude photographers, apart from, as would everybody, the creeps of the world. And the problem in photography is there are the high profile cases. I'm not going to name any names because I don't know how litigious these people are, but there are photographers, if you Google them, you will find very quickly exactly who I'm talking about. And that has caused a lot of damage. And you then have the local camera club level of known creeps in any area. And everyone knows that models who work locally, they have like a blacklist of people. Mm-hmm. And they will warn each other about it. As far as I'm concerned, that has nothing to do with photography. That is just predators using photography as a medium. That has nothing to do with the art of photography. And I'd like to separate that very distinctly when we're talking about these subjects. You know, yes, they're using it, but in, you know, loads of people use lots of different mediums for evil. It doesn't mean it's the medium that's the fault, you know?
No, exactly. You know, You could apply that to almost anything. And I think we've sort of spoken about this, and it's all down to the intent.
Yes.
And that's the clear distinction between people doing this properly and people doing this improperly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we're going into a lot. I'm still working on the essay now because it is not as clear cut as it seems, because there is one, the intent, which is really important, but there's also the public perception, which I also think is important, especially when it tars an entire genre of work. Like in the singularity, it doesn't matter, but when you're looking at the, you know, across the board, I think it does matter. There's also taste, what people think is tasteful. I've got, I don't know, have you seen the china plate with something very rude written on it near the sink?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, have a look after this. It is so rude, I can't repeat it on the internet. I find it funny. Somebody else might not. Now, I don't care if they don't find it funny. It's not for them. It's for me. But at the same time, I respect that they can find that deeply offensive. I would take it down if my grandma came into the studio. Let's put it that way. I'd take a lot of things down if my grandma came into the studio. Because I don't want to offend her, because I know it would offend her. But at the same time, just because it offends her doesn't mean it's wrong.
No, and this is, you know, this is a whole different basket of eggs. It's... There's people will tell you, well, that's offensive. So, no, you find it offensive.
Yes,
it isn't inherently offensive.
And my thing is, if someone comes up to me and goes, I find that offensive, if I can do something, like say they're working in the studio and they're like, I've just seen that in the near the sink and I find it really offensive, I'll be like, I am so sorry I've offended you. I would take it down. And obviously put it back up when they're gone, but like, I don't want to, just because I don't find it offensive doesn't mean I want someone else to be offended, and it's no skin off my nose to take it down. But at the same time, it doesn't mean it is offensive. It's just offensive for them, like you say.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the crime of the century either. Yeah. I mean, I don't find any swear words offensive at all. And as we've discovered whilst editing for Studio Access, there's a lot of swear words in there. Apparently I swear like a trooper.
Mouth of a sailor.
Yeah. who knew? Obviously I don't do that on YouTube because they don't pay us if we do that.
No. Demonetization.
Yes, quite. But yeah, I mean, there's quite a weird one over there as well, actually, with a cat on it. But yeah, so anyway, I put a lot of time into this video because I think it's quite an interesting one. And there's a lot to it. And there's a huge debate. Like, I follow this account because I find it funny, but it basically trolls nude photographers on Instagram who are horrific photographers. And there's a whole debate over like when I was like, well, if a nude's done well and tastefully, but no one starts off good. So what, until you're good, you can't do it?
Well, I think
it's like, there's a lot there, isn't there? Certain package. Yeah.
You know, and especially when you, you know, if you have a muse, somebody you've worked with for years and whatever.
Yeah.
And you say, right, I'd like to, you know, explore this style of photography. Is that okay with you? If you know, you've probably put a bit of work in. It's not, it generally wouldn't be the first thing you'd start off doing.
No.
You generally, I think, on your route to sort of, you know, sort of fine art nude or whatever, would be you'd go through, you know, you'd start with landscapes and street photography, which is what everybody does, and then you kind of, you know, evolve from that, and you know, usually into a studio setting. You know, you've probably got some experience behind you, and you've got some sort of modicum of technical know-how, and dare I say it, the word taste, by the time you kind of find yourself at that point.
Yeah, but some photographers never have taste in any genre.
There is that, but
you know, without sounding too harsh, there's some people just don't, like, they'll never have it. Much in the same way that, like, I would never write a book. Like, there's no amount of lessons, workshopping, and help that will get me to be able to write a book. Unless it's a literal, today I walked down the street and had a coffee. Like, I could never come up with a story and write it like that. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's an interesting topic. And I thought the response was quite interesting. And there's also a point as well. I mean, we do have a very heavy male bias in the group, but not that heavy, where it was just all men discussing photography, mm-hmm. and everyone assumed nudes meant women. Which again, I don't see many male nude photographs.
No. And I think if you,
but look, maybe because I'm a man that gets served up on socials.
And I think if you look at the industry in general, it's probably no surprise that I'd say 90% of photographers are men.
Yeah.
And 90% of the models are women.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a coincidence.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I was just like racking my brains trying to think of a famous male nude that I liked. And obviously there's a William Eggleston, one of the dentist, who I think got murdered. I assume not during the shoot.
Hopefully not.
But the Eggleston only ever took one frame of each thing. So there's probably just that one shot of him naked. And I think there's quite a few naked men stranded in Canton as well that he shot as a video. But yeah, I can't think of any famous male nudes.
No, I mean, there's been plenty of paintings, obviously, in the Renaissance and what have you. You know, there was, you know, I think, if anything, there was more men painted nude than women back in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we're still researching the video. Anyway, I thought it was going to be a quick one. I'd ask some answers from the group. And we're going to do it as like how perception changes through time on the same art form. But it turns out that the subject matter was bigger than I anticipated. So it's currently kind of half written and now on the back burner, probably until over that weird Christmas to New Year gap where I've got nothing to do. But yeah, that's where we're going with that. I just thought, you know, as I'd clarified my Godox hate, I thought I'd clarify my nude hate, or lack thereof. But yes, I think it's easy to forget when we're on YouTube, people only see what you put out there. So they see one dimension of what it is that you're putting out into the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, it's like, yeah, you must do this, you must do that. And it's like, there's more to a person than just the one dimensional, this is what I like and this is what I do. You'll see it on the bookcase, which is currently being hidden by the massive hazy light behind me. There's a lot of nude books in there. I don't have any qualms with nude photography.
No.
Just don't do it myself. But I don't know. Maybe I'll tell you what. If you want a nude calendar of me and Rob, we'll for 2025.
That's a niche market.
That's a niche market. We could probably charge a lot for it though, with it being so niche. We'll sort you out.
The bills for therapy alone.
We'll get Godox to sponsor it.
I know. And, who would we get to take the pictures?
We'd have to do it on self-timer. We couldn't make anyone do that. That would. Yeah, that would be as cancelled straight away. But there we go. Anyway, thank you very much for stopping by again.
No, always a pleasure.
And we'll see you next week.
Ciao for now.